Howdy, this is Jim Mars, your host here today on this Dreamlands subscriber program, and today we're talking with Joseph P. Farrell, the author of several books, fascinating books, I might add. But today, specifically, we're going to be talking about one of his latest books, Roswell and the Reich. Of course, the Roswell case of July 1947 is a mainstay in the UFO literature, and it has almost become a given that this was an instance of where the U.S. government confiscated and suppressed any information about a crashed flying saucer, a UFO, a ship from another planet, a ship from another world. Joseph P. Farrell has a little bit different take on the whole thing, and in the wake of the fascinating and wide-ranging interview that Joseph had with Whitley Strieber, I hardly know where to begin. But Joseph, since we do have a time constraint, let's just start by, again, if you would, reiterate your basic thesis about what you think actually happened at Roswell in July of 1947.
Well, Jim, my basic premise or thesis in the book is that if we examine the technology that is reported of the debris that's recovered, and if we examine the military's, in my opinion, near panic reaction to it, if we follow that technology, if we follow the documents, the fingers are pointing very clearly back to Nazi Germany. So my thesis is basically that what crashed was something Nazi, that it was a piece of Nazi technology. And by Nazi, I want to be very clear. I do not mean that it was something from an American black project being run by the paperclip Nazi scientists that we brought to this country. I mean that it is the clear representative of some independent post-war Nazi organization that's continuing to develop this technology independently of any of the victorious powers after World War II, and using it to surveil and reconnoiter over sensitive American defense installations. And my rationalization then for the cover-up of the incident stems not only to the technological implications, but also to the political implications, because this would have meant, really, quite literally, that the old enemy was not defeated, and that fact had to be kept hidden, very well hidden, and carefully guarded from the American public.
So basically you're saying that this had to be kept secret both for technological and political reasons.
Right, right. Although, like I said in the interview with Whitley, my chips really fall on the political angle of it, because that really is something that, had it leaked, would have forced the American government to respond. But the problem was that they didn't really know for certain where this stuff was coming from. So, you know, this is the era before satellites, you know, and satellite reconnaissance, and it would have been a very, very difficult thing to track it down and take it out, because most likely it was a project that was being hidden or fronted by some foreign government, and of course that would have involved us in international incidents and possibly war. So the political implications are kind of where I lean to explain some of the cover-up involved of the incident.
Right. So you're referring, of course, to what you call the Nazi International.
Yes.
I call it in the book the Fourth Reich, and the
right.
fact that we defeated Germany in World War II, but we did not defeat the Nazis, the National Socialists. They went underground and were operating
right.
a clandestine operation. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So.
Well, now, of course, that gets into some wide-ranging things, and I'm totally on board with you with that. But let's save that for a little bit later. Let's try to stick to Roswell. And let me make very clear here, having prior discussions with Joseph Farrell, Joseph, you're not totally dismissing the idea of extraterrestrial life or extraterrestrial crafts visiting here. You simply say that what crashed at Roswell, in your opinion, was some sort of a Nazi craft. Is that a correct assessment?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So, in other words, I don't want everybody saying that Joseph Farrell does not believe in aliens and he's trying to diss the whole topic.
No, that I'm not.
Okay, now we've got that established. So what we're dealing with is Roswell. And for the listening audience, I want to say I hardly recommend this book because no matter whether you agree with Joseph or whether you disagree with Joseph, he's put some very, very interesting facts and information together. And I think it would make all of us sit back and take a more objective and thoughtful view of Roswell, which I think is a good thing. But I have to say that what it boils down to, I suppose, is the two issues that you break it down to in your book, Roswell and the Reich, the crash debris and the bodies.
Right.
One thing that you certainly caused me to pause and reflect upon is that the idea of the alien bodies really did not surface until, 40 years after the event?
Yeah.
Go ahead and explain a little of that, if you would.
Well, one of the things, Jim, that I do in the book is I point out the fact that Roswell is kind of an ever-evolving story, and it occurs in certain layers. The very first layer of the story is simply that the U.S. Army Air Force recovered a flying saucer, and that's it. There's nothing else to it other than that. In other words, we recovered an extraordinary technology, but nothing whatsoever was said about its possible origin. The very next layer of the story, of course, is the weather balloon story that comes out within mere hours of the flying saucer story.
Which seems to be an odd cover-up.
Right, yeah. I think we're dealing, in a certain sense, with a kind of a two-layered cover-up, as Whitley mentioned in the first segment of the interview. But then much later, we get the idea that bodies were recovered, and they are of a strange enough nature that some people think that they are extraterrestrials. And I spend a great deal of time in the book going over who said what about the bodies, describing the bodies, and so on and so forth. And I point out that other than two witnesses whom the Roswell research community itself has impeached as credible witnesses, other than those two witnesses, the remaining physiological descriptions of the recovered bodies are not themselves sufficient enough to compel to the conclusion that they were dealing with an extraterrestrial life form. For me, then, that leaves the technology to be explained, and that's really the core of the original story, is the recovery of an extraordinary technology. So what I do in the book is I take the technology, the descriptions of it by Major Marcel, by Mac Brazel, his son Bill Brazel, and so on and so forth. I take all of these descriptions and break it down and attempt to trace out the potential terrestrial antecedents. And in most cases, as I come to the conclusion, as you well know in the book, in most cases that technology has clear Nazi antecedents. So my conclusion is the reason that they covered this up is, number one, they were dealing with a technology that basically left ours in the dust. Number two, it was terrestrial. Number three, the political part, the bad news was it was Nazi.
Right. Well, so the idea of putting out a story that it was letting the rumor get going and letting it start that we've captured a flying saucer may have
right.
been an effort to distract the public from the fact that they had Nazi or technology or some sort of unusual, extraordinary technology. This has always kind of bothered me, though, because even going back to the mogul balloon idea that it was some sort of a secret mogul balloon, and they wanted to cover that up. And so we can substitute for the mogul balloon Nazi technology. They wanted to cover that up, so they put out the word that they've captured a flying saucer because they didn't want Soviet spies, alerted and that just really bothers me because, you know, if you put out a story that says we've captured a flying saucer with the implication that it might be something unworldly, to me that seems that would be like flies drawn to honey.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like, you know, they're going to draw every Soviet spy in the world to New Mexico.
To New Mexico. Yeah, to try and find out if we had an extra. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make much sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
But I can certainly see the attitude, though, that we do not want to shock a war-weary population. Keep in mind, it's only 2 years after the end of World War II, and also just a few months after the ill-fated Project High Jump, where Ethel Byrd took a military fleet down to Antarctica, prepared, geared, and supplied for 7 to 9 months, and they came back inside 2 months, and it's like, I don't know what happened to them down there, but it apparently was not very positive. So the thing that really bothers me, though, is that, as Whitley pointed out, the people at that time in charge of the military were very, very pro-American, very patriotic. They just got through fighting a war against the Nazis. And while I can understand that they might have not wanted the public to understand that the Nazis survived the war and were still operating, and in fact operating with very advanced technology that they probably were very, very concerned about, what I don't understand, and perhaps you can explain to me, is why was there not covert steps taken to stop the spread of the Nazi ideology in the United States? Because it was not. You know, if they had discovered a Nazi international with the crash at Roswell, I think they would have, at the very least, suspended Project Paperclip, if not, in turn, those Nazi scientists. I think also they would have begun to look for infiltration of Nazis into our government, and I'm not sure that we would have had the Kennedy assassination, which there is very clearly a Nazi element involved in, and I don't think we would have had the penetration of the Republican Party by Nazi ethnic committees and the rise of the neoconservative movement, which is basically another term for National Socialism. So can you explain to me why they didn't take steps to stop all that, even if it was under the table?
Well, one of the things I get into in the book is that it is very curious that prior to Roswell, there was basically no counterintelligence surveillance of those German paperclip scientists in this country. It is after Roswell that you see many of the counterintelligence files being reopened on some of these characters, and in my opinion, one of the most suspicious of these characters that they reopen the files on is Dr. Kurt Davis. I get into that in Roswell and the Reich. Now, just so that people know who Dr. Davis is, he is one of the scientists that, in my opinion, was very clearly involved with the Nazi Bell Project. He ends up as a senior flight administrator during the Apollo program at Cape Canaveral. So, in other words, he becomes a very highly placed administrative figure within NASA. So his file is reopened after the Roswell incident. So you do have a certain response, I think, by the American authorities to something that happened circa 1947 or early 1948 when these files are reopened. Now, the other thing I point out is that if you read General Shulgin's collection memo, intelligence collection memorandum, which was drawn up in September of 1947, in other words, within a couple of months after the Roswell incident, it's very clear, if you read that document in its authentic version, and there's an unauthentic version that has been cited by Roswell researchers, but if you read it in its authentic version, it is very clear that he is very subtly pointing fingers to Nazi Germany and to Nazi technology, and having his agents find out where this stuff is coming from. So in other words, there is a response, but it's what we would expect the military to do. They're trying to find out, first of all, who's doing it, and number two, where is it coming from, so that a response can then be made. Now, I do not get into what I'm about to say in the book, but I think your question is important enough to speculate a bit here. if we look at the post-Roswell activities of these Nazis, one of the things that emerges from the intelligence, the counterintelligence documents, is that prior to Roswell, these Nazis were going over to Mexico, that they had mail drops, that they were receiving enormous amounts of money from no one knew where, money that certainly exceeded their salaries as scientists for the U.S. government. But after Roswell, you see the activity decline. So the whole thing here that I want to point out is the possibility that maybe these scientists, if they had any connection to that post-war Nazi International, they most likely were told to lay low and take it easy because they would have been much more valuable to that organization in place inside of American Black Projects than they would have been cashiered out of the United States back to Europe or wherever they might have gone. So I think it's an excellent question.
So what you're saying is that it drove them deeper underground.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned the Bell Project, and I think maybe it's worth a little digression right here because one of the arguments against the Nazi technology theory at Roswell would be that, well, it was 1947. Think of a 1947 car. It's an antique, a classic,
right.
You know, so any technology in 1947 would certainly be known now. And I think, though, that that's coming from the standpoint of some sort of a rocket technology or even magnetic technology. So why don't you explain a little bit about the Bell Project, because they were dealing with very exotic energy transformation technology,
yes.
Which could explain why it's still classified, because perhaps they haven't been able to develop that fully.
Well, the Bell, to outline it in a nutshell, the Bell was Nazi Germany's most highly classified wartime secret project. It was given the classification or a statement of Kriegsentscheidend, which in German means decisive for the war. Okay, this classification made it higher than the Nazi atom bomb. So in other words, if you put it into context, the atom bomb is kind of old hat. The Bell Project, I believe, the Nazis conceived as a gateway technology to get them to three different things. The first was for the ability to tap into the so-called zero-point energy, pardon me, or the energy of space-time. The second purpose that they were after was a practical field propulsion, or to put it succinctly, anti-gravity. Excuse me. And the third thing that they were after was some sort of technology, excuse me, that if weaponized would give them basically the ultimate doomsday weapon.
Wow. Well, that's certainly enough to keep it classified for whoever got their hands on it.
Absolutely.
So this would also give them a political edge, namely, I guess, in blackmail, right?
Yes, I think so. And as I point out in my book, The Nazi International, I think the basic core of the Bell Project came not to this country, not to the Soviet Union, but remained in independent hands and was researched by the Nazis in Argentina after the war.
Correct. Now, you mentioned time. It seems that gravity and time,
yes,
more and more seems to have an interconnection. So if you're able to suspend gravity, then perhaps you can also manipulate time.
Well, I mean, this emerges from Einstein's general relativity theory. If you're manipulating gravity, yes, you're manipulating time. And the way I normally like to put the Bell Project is that they're trying to engineer directly through this device. They're trying to engineer the fabric of space-time. And, of course, once you've said that, then, yeah, you've got a technology that leads you to those three things, to zero-point energy, to field propulsion technologies, and, of course, ultimately to the doomsday weapon.
Right. I believe it was in your book, The Secrets of the Unified Field, where you made the suggestion that the experiments with the Nazis with the Bell Project was parallel with the experiments over here, which resulted in what we know as the Philadelphia experiment.
Yes. It's basically one and the same physics that is at work in both instances. I happen to think that our scientists working on the Philadelphia Experiment Project basically were after a much lower level of manipulation of these fields than their Nazi counterparts. And when the ship disappeared, they really weren't expecting that to happen. I think with the Nazi Bell Project, you have a much more thoroughly rationalized science and technology. But in either case, the physics is the same.
Well, holy cow, could we be talking about time-traveling Nazis?
No, I don't think so. The Bell itself, if you read my books about the Bell, it was not at the stage of being a practical machine that humans could get into and fly around and do all sorts of things. So, no, I think they have to discount that possibility.
Well, yeah, it wasn't in 1944-45 when we have the only documentation and the only real narratives about the Bell. But that's more than 50-60 years ago. Mm-hmm. What could they be doing now with it?
Well, again, I think just based on the physics, I think you have to discount the possibility of time travel. There would be severe time dilation effects, but that's kind of a different thing. It's a slightly different thing than actual time travel. But I think if they have brought the technology to the pitch of development that 60 years and a lot of money and manpower would imply, then the possibility certainly exists that they have some sort of practical, real field propulsion technology at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm. Ron, I'd interject right here that in both your book, The Nazi International, and my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, we both very much detail the source, of this funding for this Nazi International. A lot of people are saying, well, you know, gee, there are a bunch of Nazis on the run. Where are they going to get money? Well, you know, I think we both pretty well covered that. I mean, they had access to the entire loot of Europe.
Yes.
Plus patents and licenses and everything that was nailed down. They took everything with them, right?
Yeah, that's basically it. I mean, in Argentina alone, as you know, Juan Perón and Martin Bormann held a joint bank account worth $800 million in 1945 dollars. That's a hefty chunk of change. So, you know, and that's just Argentina. You know, they made it out, like you say, with the loot of Europe. And that loot included, as you mentioned, patents, licenses, you know, various technologies and so on and so forth. So they were an incredibly wealthy organization.
Exactly. Well, maybe here would be the point then. Could you tell the listeners just in a capsule form about mm-hmm. the experiments down in Argentina?
Well, these were conducted ostensibly what they were supposed to be working on was controlled nuclear fusion. And the fellow heading this up for Juan Perón was a Nazi scientist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter. But if you read his actual paperclip file, the interesting thing to me, Jim, is that when this project was inadvertently exposed by Perón in 1951, the world's press and scientists denounced this man as being a complete fraud and mountebank, all right? But if you look at his paperclip...
They would have had to do that, right, to either cover up the fact that they were working on it or that they
exactly.
didn't understand it, right?
Exactly. Well, this is the thing. I don't think the project was fusion at all, because if you look at his paperclip file and the confidential interviews that the U.S. Air Force did with Richter 4 years after this fact, Richter tells them, well, what I'm really doing with this is I'm rotating plasma, I'm electrically stressing it, which is the Bell. Okay.
Right.
That's nothing
right.
but the Bell.
Rotating energy field.
Well, and he comes right out and says, what I'm trying to do is access the zero-point energy. And one of the American atomic energy scientists that reviewed Richter's comments said that this guy is a mad genius working in the 1970s, which, of course, was 20 years ahead of the time anybody of what anybody else at the time was working on. So in other words, this guy and this project were, in my opinion, probably deliberately shut down by the very Nazis that were really running it, and they simply moved it elsewhere because the world's press and spotlight was on them in Argentina. So they simply shut it down and moved it and kind of left Richter out there hanging in the wind, hoping to get a job with the American government as a result. And that, of course, didn't happen. Perón never let him out of the country. So it's a fascinating story.
Well, quickly to try to wrap up the Roswell end of this thing, because this
sure.
What we're talking about now is where I'd really like to go. In your book, you mentioned that you had at least one account where they said they found a swastika on part
yes.
of the wreckage.
Would yes.
you explain that?
Well, what was found, this is an interesting thing, and in fact, the man who reported this testimony from a dying witness that he was taking care of was in fact a man that Whitley had interviewed on a Dreamland show, a fellow by the name of Dr. John Lerma, and he published a book of accounts of, you know, his dealing with patients that were near death or suffering terminal diseases and so on and so forth. So in other words, we're dealing here with a man who is not a Roswell researcher, okay? But this story appears in his book, and I found it very fascinating, because this guy claimed to have seen some of the Roswell debris, had been shown some of this debris by Mac Brazel. And he attempted out there in the field to piece some of this debris together like a jigsaw puzzle, and when he did, he was literally stunned, because one of the symbols he found on the debris was the German Balkenkreuz, which wasn't necessarily the swastika. It was that straight-edge cross that you saw on Luftwaffe planes during World War II.
What they call the Iron Cross or something like that.
Well, it's not even technically an Iron Cross.
The Iron Cross was the Maltese cross, but this
yeah, the Iron Cross is the Maltese. Right.
Yeah.
This is the straight cross, and he does use the word Iron Cross in his description, but I think that's probably a misnomer because, you know, just a technical glitch, kind of a simple mistake, because that symbol was not used by the German military in World War II as an insignia on their vehicles. It was used by the post-war West German Army, but that wasn't in existence yet. So most likely what he was describing was really a Balkenkreuz, you know, the kind of cross that appeared on Luftwaffe planes during the Second World War. But the fact remains that what he's describing is a very patently German symbol.
you may have answered my next question, which is that, you know, so many people, we have so many people, including Jesse Marcel Jr., who saw some of the wreckage and some of the symbols.
Right.
In fact, probably mentions the symbols, and none of them have ever mentioned a swastika or even a,
right.
I'm going to go ahead and call it an Iron Cross, but I understand what you're saying. The Iron Cross was the Maltese cross. We're talking about the straight across, which was on all the German military vehicles, okay? But I'm
right.
just, for simplicity's sake, I'll say an Iron Cross. And none of them ever mentioned Iron Cross, but then
right.
what you just said was as he was piecing it together. So do I understand that he only found the Iron Cross after he put some pieces together?
Right, exactly, exactly.
So that
and
may be why others didn't notice it.
That may be, and they may have been looking at a different part of the debris field or handling different
right.
debris than what this guy handled. You know, there's any number of explanations as to why this was not seen or described by other witnesses. And again, I have to point out that this particular witness that saw this or claimed to have seen this cross, well, we are dealing here, Jim, as we are dealing so often with the witnesses for the bodies, we're dealing with second-hand dead man's testimony. So, you know, I include it in the book, but I don't rest my case on that.
Right. Yes, that's true. And that's a good caveat also. But again, I just, it seems to me, that nobody can seem to keep a secret, you know.
Right.
47 years on, we pretty well know that the Kennedy assassination was a pretty big conspiracy conducted at the top of the American government structure, and mm-hmm. even though it hasn't been officially acknowledged, we know that. We know the secrets of World War II. We now know that, you know, our generals were not all that smart. They had access to the Enigma machine, right? They were reading the German military orders, even sometimes before the field commanders got it. And we know all these secrets now. It just seems to me that, and how do you respond to this, that if indeed it was a Nazi craft that crashed in New Mexico, we would have had people talking about this, whispering about this, you know, all the way down the line, just as we now have, and as you point out so well in your book, this human narrative talking about extraterrestrials and alien bodies, et cetera, et cetera. They've all now, you know, there's hundreds now that have talked about that. How do you explain the fact that nobody seems to have said, well, you know, by the way, it was actually a Nazi craft, you know, as they lay on their deathbed or as they wrote their memoirs?
Well, let me correct one statement. We do not have hundreds of witnesses that describe bodies. In fact, that's one of the things I address in the book. When you get right down to it, the descriptions of the bodies are, for the most part, from dead man's secondhand testimony or impeached witnesses. And of those witnesses that actually saw bodies, we can really narrow it down to a much closer selection of people than hundreds. So that is kind of a misimpression. But the other thing
I understand that, but there's been hundreds of people rumoring and writing and speaking and, you know, having all kinds of talk about it. And yet there's been no talk about a Nazi saucer until your book.
Well, actually, it's not my book that broke it. It's this doctor that broke the story. It's not me. I just include it in my book. But again, I disagree with the assumption that secrets cannot be kept. That's the whole point of my book. In fact, I spend a great deal of time dealing with the issue of secrecy and keeping secrets. We do not really know. In fact, we did not know about the Bell Project, Jim, until after German reunification and after Igor Witkowski broke the story, excuse me, by interviewing witnesses, by uncovering documents. So in other words, that story didn't break until the mid-1990s, and even then it only broke in Poland. It didn't really break out into the consciousness of researchers in the West until Nick Cook popularized it in his book, and that was in the early 2000s. So I do think that secrets can be kept. That secret was kept for a long, long time until people started connecting the dots.
That's very true, and there have been other instances of secrets well kept, such as the Manhattan Project.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But I think it's the time lag that bothers me, is it would seem that after this many years that there would be more evidence on the record to support your thesis.
Well, there's the same could be said of the extraterrestrial hypothesis and interpretation of Roswell. We would think that after that amount of time, there would be more coming out in favor of a definitive answer to that whole incident. But what we have instead are secondhand testimonies and so on and so forth. So again, I think the secret, whatever it is still being kept, because most of the explanations thus far, at least on the mundane side with the weather balloons and the extraterrestrial hypothesis, to my mind, leave me wanting. I think, in point of fact, we may be on the cusp of being able to piece it together, and that's precisely the reason I wrote the book, is to look at the details of the story as researchers have recorded it in their writings, and pointing out that most of what they're dealing with technologically goes back to the Nazis. So the secret was kept by way of a very clever kind of campaign, as far as I'm concerned, of public relations and controlling the interpretation of the event.
Right, the various levels of right. Of disinformation that you detail. Well, I think one thing that we can all, and I mean you, me, everybody listening, Whitley, everybody else, I think one thing we can all agree on is that this is still a controversy and a big question mark, because the U.S. government took the true evidence and hid it away. So
yes. You know, Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And maybe it's time to put all this aside. If it was a Nazi machine, what would be the harm in telling the truth about that now?
Well, again, I think it goes back to my original idea that the political implication of it would be to expose the post-war existence of this Nazi International, and by implication, it would further expose that element of fascist ideology and groups in this country that have a great deal of political power. So that's the secret that I think ultimately lies behind some of the...
Yes, I like that. In other words, it would peel back the green curtain, and we might
exactly.
find it was actually working towards destroying this country, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Amazing. But, all right, well, we're about out of time here, but I just have to compliment you on your even more latest book, Babylon Banksters.
Well, thank
and
you.
And I have to... bring this point in, and I think this would be a great closure, which is why, and it could again account for the secrecy, because we must demonize the Third Reich as being just, you know, run by a beast and or the Antichrist, and something that we have to just completely eschew and put behind us because of the connection, as you put it, between the alchemical and the financial, and
oh, yes.
primarily what happened there, if I'm reading you right, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that when Hitler took power, he began to move in the same direction as Abraham Lincoln did, and
absolutely.
John Kennedy did in June of 1963, which
absolutely.
Was to take the financial power of his country back and government issue non-debt-bearing money, which then, in a space of just 3 or 4 years, changed Germany from a bankrupt country with, you know, half the population out of work into a prosperous country.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they did not have to pay debt service to the international bankers.
Absolutely.
Would you agree that that would be a huge motive for keeping the Nazi connection secret, because we don't
oh, yes.
want to understand, to go and start looking at all that again?
Absolutely.
Amazing. Yes. Well, I will have to end by saying that you certainly have my attention, Joseph Farrell. But you haven't got me 100% convinced that it was a Nazi craft at Roswell, but you've certainly given me a lot to think about, and the peripheral issues, the fact that there were so few witnesses to bodies, the fact that the bodies could be perhaps explained mundanely, the fact that the Nazi International did survive, that, and particularly your great chapters on how that a lot of the technology that we have been ascribing to a alien craft at Roswell actually had their antecedents way back in the 20s and 30s in Germany and were being developed by the Nazis. This certainly gives us something to think about. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the Dreamland subscriber interview with me today.
Well, thank you, Jim. Been a pleasure.
Thank